We no longer live in a representative republic. We are no longer government of the people, by the people, for the people. Instead, we now live in a plutocracy, government of the wealthy elite, by the wealthy elite, for the wealthy elite. Income inequality has surged near levels. In fact, it surpassed the levels last seen before the Great Depression. In terms of a party with 100 people sharing a pizza with 100 slices, one rich person gobbles up 93 slices. The other 99 people get to divvy up the remaining 7 slices. That's where we live today in this country. And we wonder why things are a little unglued. It's not rocket science. In fact, I'll go off a little more. When my friend John and I, we drove through South Chicago to get here. Remember, insane idea of a 67-year-old loading trucks, and anyway, but we did it. But going through South Chicago, and as a minister, I've worked with poverty a lot, but South Chicago took my breath away. That's a degree of poverty that no one should have to suffer. So anyway, the other 99 people get the remaining 7 slices. There's something not right about that. Many of us know this trend all too well. We only have to reflect on our daily struggle to keep up with inflation and stagnant wages. That is, if you're lucky enough to be employed. If you're retired on a fixed income, good luck. Even as we gather this morning, the middle class, the working poor, and the poor face dire consequences as health insurance, Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security all hang in the balance. It truly does. What was once the tyranny of the British Crown is now the tyranny of the wealthy elite. It is time to rekindle the patriot's dream, to rekindle the spirit of 1776. I highly recommend a book by two political scientists, Jacob Hacker and Paul Pearson. I happened to catch them on PBS in a Bill Moyers interview. The title is Winner Take All Politics. The subtitle is even more telling: How Washington Made the Rich Richer and Turned Its Back on the Middle Class. Copyright 2010. You see, this book was written in the aftermath of the Bush meltdown. It seems the wealthy elite have declared war on the middle class ever since FDR and the New Deal. Their golden age is a return to the roaring 20s. Their goal has been to dismantle the New Deal step by step. They called Eisenhower a socialist for building the interstate highway system with federal funds. Eisenhower laughed. Ronald Reagan was when they really got their foot in the door, and no one but them is laughing now. A major key to their blueprint was to cripple the unions. Once the unions were neutralized, the middle class would lose all influence in Congress. It worked. However, if one is to be honest, and one should be, the unions played a large hand in their own undoing. Power corrupts. Jimmy Hoffa was only the tip of the iceberg. Usually, economists talk of the economy as an independent, living creature, much in the tradition of Adam Smith in the 18th century. However, Jacob Hacker and Paul Pearson connect the dots between elite money and actual legislation from Ronald Reagan to 2010. They connect every dot, every piece of legislation, every dismantling of the New Deal. It's a great book if you have stomach for it. But I want to move on to a time when the American Revolution was a burning coal in the hearts of the people. The place is Pawtucket, Rhode Island. The context is the textile industry. The event is the strike of 1824. This is only but one tiny chapter in our nation's broken covenant that haunts us to this day. The sad triangle of Southern slavery, Northern textile mills, and Britain's insatiable thirst for finished cotton. The textile workers' strike of 1824 takes place just 37 years before the American Civil War. From 1790 to 1820, Pawtucket, Rhode Island — I lived in Rhode Island, and when I found this out, it amazed me — Pawtucket, Rhode Island was the most important industrial village in the United States. It wasn't Massachusetts, it was Rhode Island. Children and women made for cheap, unskilled labor. The percentage of children in the Pawtucket's cotton mills declined from almost 70% of the total workforce in 1820 to 40% in 1831. Wow, 70% children. Over the same period, the percentage of women increased from 16% to 30%. This increase in young women workers will be important soon. Of course, the mill owners were an emerging class of the wealthy elite. However, they faced rapid technological innovation, which caused bursts of overproduction and declining cloth price. Someone would have to bear this loss of profit, and it certainly wasn't going to be them. One Monday, they decided to run their mills 1 hour longer without pay. They also decided to reduce by 25% the wages of those who weave by the yard. This decision affected only the young women weavers. The mill owners underestimated the young women. They went on strike. They refused to work. This was the first strike by women in America. Not only did their fellow workers support their strike, but so did the village people, the farmers, the artisans, even the neighboring townships. The young women's support was strengthened by the democratic ideology of the American Revolution. The village and its neighboring townships have provided active support for the revolution and maintained strong democratic traditions. The crowd acted in defense of community standards and a notion of the common good. Now reflect on that today. How many Americans even think of the common good anymore? It's all about me. The patriot's dream among these folks had never died. It remained in the hearts of the people. Of course, the mill owners struck a compromise. They had no other choice in the matter. 5 years later, the village newspaper turned its fire directly on the mill owners. And think of today when you hear this. Every village, as well as every monarchy, has its tyrant. Wealth and talents constitute someone to domineer over the multitude and to keep down the poor and the indigent. We have seen more of this in the manufacturing communities than any other. We have seen it in our own village. There are individuals in manufacturing communities who, from the habit of ruling the children in their mills with a rod of iron, and from dealing out to them barely enough to cover their nakedness, have acquired the belief that they may step out into the community with the same air and browbeat all who came their way, as if they too were dependent on them for subsistence. What is this but tyranny? Nothing to which the human mind is subjected is so degrading as this. And here's the kick. It converts people, free, independent people, into a tool to be used for the very worst of purposes. Pawtucket Chronicle, August 29, 1829. In this age of raging narcissism and unbridled capitalism in which we live, it's time to rekindle the patriot's dream. But what would be our defense of community standards in our notion of the common good? What would we say today? This is a conversation that is so long overdue as a people in this nation. A conversation more about we than about me. So that this nation shall have a new birth of freedom in the government of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from the earth. Happy Labor Day, everyone. You know, there's a story about the Buddha. He was getting up to talk, and a bird let out some singing, and Buddha just sat down and said, the sermon has already been delivered. It feels as if the benediction's already been delivered. But I'm going to do the benediction anyway. And our benediction is from David Hicks McPherson. To wish for compassion, to pray for courage, to experience doubt, to bear sorrow, to strive for sureness. All these are qualities for which each of us should be grateful. But to feel a genuine fellowship for the whole human family, to act so that our empathy is evident wherever we go, that's the object. That's the lifelong goal. Amen, and blessed be. Jeff.